This is Scott Becker with a special joint podcast between Becker's Healthcare and Becker Group Women's Leadership. We're thrilled today to talk about something called the diversity tax and avoiding the diversity tax, learning to say no. We've got three magnificent participants that I'll ask to introduce themselves. We've got Suba Berry, the president of Working Mother Media. We've got Julia Lopez, a fantastic lawyer, Reed Smith. And we have Alexis Robertson, who's the director of diversity and inclusion at Foley & Lardner. I also owe a special thanks for organizing and creating the subject for us today to Karen Kaplowitz and Suba Berry. So thank you. Suba, let me ask you to introduce yourself, and then I'll ask Julie and Alexis to introduce themselves as well.
Thank you so much, Scott. I am the president of Working Mother Media, where I oversee the Working Mother magazine, workingmother.com, Diversity Best Practices, which is a leading corporate membership organization supporting diversity and inclusion, the National Association of Female Executives, and the Culture at Work division, which is our newest bespoke consulting practice. I consider myself a leader on issues of diversity and inclusion, but as an organization, we are best known for our 100 Best Companies for Working Mothers, and very specifically on a survey that we do for the best law firms for women. We have been doing this since 2007, and I'm really excited to be on this call with you.
Thank you, Suba, and Working Mothers, throughout the magnificent presence and just well read and thought of. Julia, can you introduce yourself?
Yes. Hi, Scott, and hi, everyone. My name is Julia Lopez. I'm a senior litigation associate in Reed Smith's Life Sciences Health Industry Group in Princeton, New Jersey. Overall, I defend a drug and medical device manufacturers in New Jersey and across the country. I'm also a diversity and inclusion leader. I'm the immediate past president of the Hispanic Bar Association of New Jersey, and I am now the president for Region 3 and National Deputy Finance Director for the Hispanic National Bar Association.
Oh, that's fantastic. And Julia, very quickly, people might not realize Reed Smith is an Amwell 100 firm, one of the largest, most successful firms in the country. And congratulations on what you do with Reed Smith, a magnificent law firm. Alexis, can you introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you, Scott. My name is Alexis Robertson, and by the time this airs, I will be the Director of Diversity and Inclusion at Foley & Lardner, although I'm about 6 days out from starting that role. I just finished 2.5 years with Baker McKenzie as a North America Manager of Diversity and Inclusion. And in my prior life, I practiced for about 7.5 years. The bulk of that was at Kirkland & Ellis as a commercial litigator, followed by about 1.5 years at Seyfarth Shaw as an employment litigator. And I then spent a few years also as a legal recruiter, where I primarily placed diverse attorneys with law firms and corporations.
Well, fantastic, and thank you very much. And Foley & Lardner, like Reed Smith, one of the great law firms in the country, another AmLaw 100 firm that's got just a fantastic reputation. So thank you for joining us today. Suba, talk to us about the diversity tax, and what is the diversity tax?
Well, the diversity tax, imagine being one of the few, whether it's diverse lawyers, diverse employees, diverse people in your organization. And imagine when any conversation comes up that relates to a diversity and inclusion issue, and immediately all heads turn to you. So that becomes a de facto job that you carry within your organization. You know, in a law firm, if you're one of the few diverse lawyers, that means that you're being asked to represent your firm on client pitches, client teams, firm committees. You know, if it's Heritage Month, they want you to be there to help organize it. Anytime there is any diversity-related issue, there's you. And that takes a toll on the amount of time that you can spend doing, quote-unquote, your day job, which is to bring in new clients in a law firm and to bill. And so that is the tax that I call diversity tax.
It's fascinating. And when was this term? Do you know when the diversity tax, that term, was coined, or where was that coined, or when?
Well, you know, it's been around for a very long time. You know, I'm an Indian woman who came to this country from India about 35 years ago. And I always say that, you know, it's there's this notion of being the token somebody. And I have experienced that through my career, but it's only in sort of the recent years. And it was very specifically at our 2019 Best Law Firms for Women program. And Julia was speaking on a panel, and she was talking about the challenges of being a woman lawyer, and especially somebody who looks young and who is young. And she pointed to the fact that she has to constantly deal with, you know, learning to have all these things come at her, these requests to do X, Y, and Z, and for her to be the one to be wise about saying no. And I thought to myself, oh, wow, this is what I wish I had learned when I was in early career, because guess what? When you're junior and they ask you, you usually lead with a yes, and you don't even get to the yes, but it's just yes, and you go do it. And so, you know, hearing Julia talk about how she has been wise about making those choices said to me that there is a tax that's being levied, and people that are wise, like the Julias of the world, can figure out how to get around it. And that's something that needs to be taught and learned.
It's a fascinating subject. And I think as you talk about it, we all see many instances of it in every professional services firm and every company that we're a part of. It's a fascinating discussion. Julia, can you tell us some of your experience with this and how you manage it?
Absolutely. So I'll start by saying, you know, I've been practicing now for 13 years. So a lot of that wisdom has been gained along the way by great mentors that have shared their experiences with me and told me not to be shy about saying no. But I joined the firm, Reed Smith, about 5 years ago at a time when I was the only Latina associate in our Princeton office. And in the past 5 years, we've made tremendous strides in increasing our diverse presence within our Princeton office and across the United States. And I think I'd like to say it had something to do with that myself. But, you know, in addition to working for my clients and to be actively involved in the bar associations, as I mentioned earlier, I've also served in various leadership roles at my firm, including serving as the associate chair for our business inclusion group for Latino attorneys and personnel. It's a business inclusion group called Unidos. I've also served as the associate chair for the Princeton Diversity Committee. And I've served on the recruitment committee and the summer associate committee. And in all these capacities, I mentor junior associates. I'm frequently asked to participate on pitches to represent my firm on anything. And it's in a way, it's a good thing. It's because my firm values diversity and inclusion, but it is a very taxing responsibility because I have to spend a lot of time, a lot of non-billable time in pursuit of these goals and in representing my firm. And the other thing that I should point out is that the diversity tax does not just end with my firm. As they say, to whom much is given, much will be required. So as an attorney of color who grew up as an immigrant in an inner city, my obligations and responsibility extend to my community as well. And so, you know, I think attorneys of color understand that they are in a position of privilege and feel a sense of responsibility and obligation to give back and to help others succeed. So that's why I think you're pulled in various directions, and it makes it very difficult, especially as a junior attorney, to focus on your career and on becoming the best attorney that you can be, which is what you should be doing. So when I speak to young attorneys and law students in New Jersey and across the country, I always remind them that the diversity tax exists and that they have to be focused on making it before they can help others. So in other words, kind of like the airplane or like the boat analogy, you have to put on your life jacket on first before you can place it on someone else.
Oh, fantastic. And what a fascinating life experience, Julia. And I could see it at firms, how many times the person who's diverse gets called on for so many different roles. And it's fascinating to hear a name placed on this, the diversity tax, but it resonates very, very fully. So congratulations on how you're managing and how you've managed it. Any other quick pieces of advice on how people learn to sort of manage saying no or saying yes and how they manage that?
Well, I think it's something that you can't say, you're unable to say, or you don't have the, you don't feel like you have the power to say early on in your career because you're still trying to establish yourself. But I think what I always tell attorneys is that you need to become the best attorney that you can be first. And then you happen to, and then the fact that you happen to be diverse, Latina, Black, Asian, whatever it is, it's just a bonus. So, you know, as far as, you know, dealing with it, dealing with the diversity tax, I would say definitely try to say yes early on in your career because you're still establishing yourself. But as you grow into your role at your firm, you need to start being strategic and intentional about the roles and responsibilities that you decide to take.
Certainly, and thank you. And Alexis, you've heard Julia speak. You attended Working Mother conferences as a senior leader in diversity. Some of your perspectives on these questions, some of your thoughts.
Yeah, and actually the way this came up was that I was at the panel where Julie spoke, and I kind of stood up with a question, but also a comment, which was, and I think Julie has actually reiterated this perfectly, which is, but this is hard. So to just tell a diverse attorney or a person of color to simply say no, learn to say no, you really have to acknowledge just how difficult that is. And to reiterate what Julie just said, not only is it the organization will look to you, but you will often put a tremendous amount of pressure on yourself to start giving back almost immediately. I think about a month ago, had grabbed a coffee with a first-year associate at a very large law firm. She wanted to meet with me because her question was, how do I get more involved with diversity and inclusion at my firm? And one of the first things I said to her was, hold on, your first priority is learning to be a good lawyer. But she reflected the exact same things that Julia said, which was, I'm an immigrant to this country. So many people fought for me to be where I am, and I'm ready to give back. And I said, I hear you. But you do need to focus on being the best lawyer you can be. Hopefully you have a 30, 40, 50 year career. And not to sound glib about it, but if you don't spend a lot of time giving back in these first 5 or 10 years, that's just fine. As long as you've made it to a point where you're able to continue being a great attorney. But overall, what I've found the problem is that instead of organizations figuring out how to relieve that tax, they will just find a new person. But what we really want to do is make that person's peers, as well as the organization, just raise their competency so that they're able to represent all of the people and not have to look to individuals to represent their interests. That is not a solution, and our solutions need to be far more systemic so that we can stop levying that tax on individuals.
I know, it's a fascinating perspective on the concept of it's got to be a systematic plan, systemic efforts, institutional efforts, not just pushing it on the particular different minorities that fit the different bill for the different situations, because that ends up overloading them with stuff. And then when they can't do as well as they should on their billable hours or they're building business and so forth, people don't realize they've been distracted by 13 different requests and all these different requests on things. And so fascinating advice. Thank you for sharing, Alexis. Julia, a couple of examples where you've been able to say no, and how do you learn to say no on these things?
Sure. So, you know, yes, we all make sacrifices, and that's what we struggle with as diverse attorneys of color, right? But it's important to say no. And I'll give you two examples. The first one, last year, as I mentioned, I was serving as the 39th president of the Hispanic Bar Association. I was asked to organize a Hispanic Heritage Month celebration at my firm. Something that, you know, it's great that my firm is doing. It's great that my firm takes pride in celebrating our history across all our offices. But at the time, I was serving as the leader for a statewide bar association, and I had already been asked by 5 separate organizations to speak at their Hispanic Heritage celebrations throughout the state. So although, you know, I had to be smart about it, and I had to say no to organizing this internal event in my firm, I was nonetheless elevating Latino attorneys at each of these other events. And I elevated my brand, I elevated my firm's profile, and I sent an important message at each of these events. This is why the sacrifice was acceptable in my view. I shared my personal story of immigrating to this country, growing up in an inner city, and working hard to live the American dream. And I shared facts with everyone at these events about the legal profession and how we're not represented by the population of the state. So in a state like New Jersey, where 18% of the citizens are Latino, we still only have 4% Latino attorneys, less than 2% are women, and less than 1% actually make it to become Latino partners in big law, that needs to change. So for me, it was a trade-off that was necessary, smart, strategic, and intentional. I understand that I had to say no to people that are important to me, and my firm is very important to me, and my role here is important. But I also, you know, take on these other leadership responsibilities and roles so that I can recruit more Latinos to this firm, so I'm not the only one, and so that we can all share in these responsibilities. So that's my first example. My second example, you know, I do a lot of pro bono work because that's important to me. It's important to give back to the communities that have raised me. And one of our clients in particular, we have a lot of partnerships with several of our clients, but one of our clients has done a lot of landlord-tenant work. And I had to say no to participating in this. Again, I had to be strategic and intentional about my choices because I have other things that I'm working on and there's only so many hours in a day. So instead, you know, I participated in the Client Inclusion Leader Program where with the same client, I was able to work with them on staffing more diverse teams on matters, increasing the diversity on our teams, working on our mutual and aligned goals between this client and our firm, and representing, you know, my own brand at the firm and with the client at all of their diversity events and programs. So it's a much more strategic way to look at things, and this is why, you know, you can't do it from the minute you start because you have to establish yourself at a law firm, especially a big law firm like Reed Smith. But over time, you have to learn how to say no and pull others up along the way. Since I started at the firm, I've been able to impact and have the firm hire three diverse candidates who are now successful attorneys at Reed Smith.
Well, Julia, just fantastic. And what you say resonates so well. I see, just as an example, some of my African-American colleagues and partners get called onto every diversity panel, every diversity pitch. And at some point, it's almost embarrassing to ask them because they almost get painted as the diversity person versus just a great lawyer. And in fact, the chairman of our firm is a diverse person, an African-American lawyer, chairman of a, 1500 lawyer firm. But it's fascinating how much of this he gets pulled into, so many people get pulled into and so forth. And I'm so glad to hear the open discussion of this issue. It's fascinating to listen to your thoughts on it and to hear perspectives on it. Thank you. Alexis, a couple examples you have a situation you've seen where lawyers feel compelled, diverse lawyers feel compelled to say yes to all these requests they get.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I've seen that throughout my career while practicing as well as now that I'm on the diversity and inclusion side of things. So I think it starts at the very young, that first and second year, who's always going to those recruiting lunches, things like that. And the thing about it is a lot of them actually really enjoy that. It's fun. But before you know it, that time really adds up. And the important thing to note is it's not compensated necessarily depending at the firm you attend, and it's not even acknowledged depending on the firm you're in. Many firms just look at your billable hours. They may or may not nod to that sort of firm love time, but that tends to be where it begins. But then I've also heard feedback from diverse attorneys who just say, you know, if I am not in that meeting when it comes to hiring, and they'll get put on every single committee within the firm, and they've had to learn how to say no to that and to only be on those committees that are strategic for them. And this doesn't quite answer your question, but something I wanted to raise and to reiterate that Julie's just said so well is that as a diverse attorney, when you are put in these positions, figuring out the angle for you to be strategic and promote your career in addition to furthering diversity within the firm, which Julie's obviously been doing an amazing job at. I'm just sitting here kind of nodding and smiling as she talks. But for example, a lot of times diverse attorneys will be tapped to be affiliate network or ERG leads. So instead of, you know, the strategic point for that, instead of just looking at programming you can have, how can you use that to grow your network? If you're the chair of the Black attorney group within your law firm, you can use that to meet and to bring in speakers and to grow your personal network and your opportunities instead of just seeing it as, okay, what's our programming for the year? So really putting on a strategic hat to enhance your career and not have it merely be just more work or homework. And the other thing I want to add, I know we call it diversity tax, but I really can't stress enough the tremendous energy expenditure this requires. So yes, it's your additional time, but energy, I think, is your most precious commodity, particularly as a lawyer. And anything that is siphoning your energy without much of a payoff to you, you know, outside of those hours you should spend just, you know, contributing to the community, but without much direct payoff, is a problem and something you really need to examine and be strategic about.
But Alexa, I think that's great advice on multiple fronts. One is to be very strategic about what assignments, what appointments, what committees you join and participate in. Are they really important to your mission, to the firm's mission? Do you really want to do them? Are they good for your career? Or is it something you're basically going to get not credit for and not enjoy anyway? So being very strategic. And then the other concepts you mentioned, just fascinating as well. So thank you. Subha, any thoughts on the subject of diverse leaders and being willing to say no? And then I'll just point on Alexis. I think the most important thing you said, and I'll come back to Subha on this, is this concept of the energy issue. There's nothing more important in anybody's professional career than their energy level. And if these things take away from your energy rather than add to it, it makes you less able to succeed. And I think that is probably the most brilliant overriding point in everything we do. If things sap your energy and distract you, then you're not getting better and building your career. So a great, great point. Subha, back to you. Why is it so important for diverse leaders to be able to say no? Any comments you wanted to add on here?
Well, firstly, I want to say this is such a I feel like I'm reliving that panel that morning from our Best Law event, and I was so inspired, and I thought every up-and-coming, whether it's a lawyer or a diverse individual within a corporation, needs to hear this advice, knowing that, you know, when they say jump, you don't always say how high. But I really think about this building of this competency, learning how to say no, is actually building a leadership competency. And in that process, you're exhibiting so many other things that you are also learning. I know how to prioritize. I know how to delegate. I know how to communicate with clarity and empathy, even when I'm saying no. I know how to be commanding, strategic, intentional. I'm setting an example for others to follow. I could go on and on about the kinds of other competencies, leadership competencies, you are learning and building as you learn to sift through what is offered to you and not always jumping at the first one. The other interesting point I want to make is, you know, you talk about energy, and the example that comes to mind is, have you ever seen how birds fly south for the winter? They fly in that V formation. There's a lead bird that cuts the wind, and they're flying. And guess what the lead bird does? Because if it's going to lead all the way through, that lead bird is going to drop dead somewhere halfway around, not even half, a quarter way around. So the reality is the lead bird then comes to the middle of the back and coasts. And there is another bird that comes in and takes that lead role and cuts the wind, because it is exhausting the kind of energy it takes from you. So I ask every diverse leader to keep that in mind, knowing that if you say yes to everything, you are not going to last. And like Alexis said, you will not have the energy for the real important work. So I would say to you, you know, learning how to delegate this, allowing others to do it, leading with your example is a powerful way both to preserve yourself as well as to ensure that others can follow that pathway that you've carved.
I think that's fantastic advice. I mean, it's really something where you have to tag team leadership in to use your example to be able to retain energy for the long run and keep contributing in a very positive way. I think it's just great advice. I'm going to ask each of you for sort of a final recommendation for diverse leaders in law firms, sort of best advice or a quick thought, just a quick 30 seconds to a minute to wrap up. Julia, you've been so articulate on what you do. Let me start with you on sort of recommendation for diverse leaders in law firms.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, speaking of leadership, you have to get involved in leadership roles at your firm, because the only way you're going to be able to impact change is by being at in the room. You have to be at the boardroom in order to hire more diverse attorneys to change the numbers that currently exist that are still dismal across the United States and in big law and other places, you know, because we do need to, I think all the firms are catching on to the fact that we need to continue to embrace ways to be inclusive, but we also need to find ways to support our diverse attorneys, and that is by supporting their careers first, investing in their careers, exposing them to good work, to meaningful interactions with clients, to making them become the best attorneys first. And then it'll become apparent that they're also, they're not just good attorneys, but they happen to be diverse, Latino, Black, disabled, whatever it is. And for the diverse attorneys, I think what's important is that they never forget their roots, and I think it's important for them to stay connected to diverse organizations like the bar associations, and that was a tremendous outlet for me, because you're not going to succeed in big law unless you have that support system. It is often very isolating, and until the numbers change, we need to have good support systems.
Well, fantastic. It's energizing and inspiring to listen to you today, Julia. Thank you for sharing your thoughts. Alexa, similar question. Best recommendation for diverse leaders in law firms?
Well, I'm actually going to change your question a little bit, just make my recommendation to leaders and to law firms, which is that in addition to, you know, giving the advice we're giving to those diverse individuals in your firm, we really need to have systemic approaches at the organizational level to alleviate this burden, to address this tax, so that those individuals don't feel that they have to be in every room, because they either know that key people or ideally everyone at the firm will have their interests. Because what we need to focus on are our people and our talent, which is all of them. I know we often hear this term inclusive leadership. I find that term to be redundant. Good leadership is inclusive. If you are a leader who is not inclusive, you're actually not a good leader, because it means you're only resonating with one sort of person or a few types of people, and that's not okay. So we all need to work, and that's really what my role does, what a diversity and inclusion professional does, is work to raise the organizational competency around these issues so that hopefully people like me don't have to exist in organizations at some point. But let's do what we need to do to alleviate this tax, and we should all be working towards that. So it didn't specifically answer your question, but that's what I would like to leave as a takeaway.
No, but it's a great answer. I mean, your concept is really, look, it's not about just what a diverse leader can do. It's systematically taking approaches to this as an institution as to how you approach this versus any particular leader. And I think it's a great piece of advice. So thank you very, very much. Suba, any final thoughts?
Well, I would say to the leaders at the law firms, we've given a lot of advice to the diverse leaders in terms of how do you manage your time? How do you prioritize? What do you do and what do you not do, et cetera? But I would say to you, the managing partners and the leadership committees within the law firms, I would say to them, you know, ask and see if you can be reverse mentored. Be curious. Think of this as something that you have to learn to build your own leadership competency. Knowing what is needed, asking the right questions, and then implementing that and acting and behaving in ways that is enabling and supportive of the diverse lawyers within your organization will actually automatically ease the burden. Very much like what Alexis said, if every leader within the law firm, every partner stepped up to do their part, then the diverse lawyers wouldn't have to do so much.
Scott, if I can just add one final point to that, we need allies at all law firms, right? It's not just about the diverse attorneys who consider themselves Latino or Black or disabled. It's about bringing everyone to the table and understanding that these are important principles that the firm should stand by.
No, I think that's fantastic, that they should be core to a firm, core to leadership. And if they become core to the firm, core to leadership, a lot of these issues start to take care of themselves or start to at least be worked out in a more fair way for everybody. I want to thank Karen Kaplowitz for bringing the subject to me. Suba, Julia, Alexis for joining us today. Always a pleasure to visit with you, and you represent great, great firms. Suba, you represent a magnificent Francis Working Mother Media and what you do, and Foley and Lardner and Reed Smith. Great, great institutions. Thank you very much for all joining us today and look forward to visiting with you more. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.